Well, the first weekend, the first full weekend of summer is here. And it feels good. A week from today is the 4th of July. Not ready for that. Welcome back to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're along. A religious figure based in Lansing is leaving town. Word from the Vatican this morning that Pope Francis has appointed Monsignor Steve Rycka, Chancellor of the Diocese of Lansing, as the fifth bishop of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Gaylord. Congratulations, Father Stephen. Bishop Earl Boyer of the Diocese of Lansing, in a statement, says, "Our loss is Gaylord's gain." Congratulations, Father Steve. Later on this hour, we take a look at the rest of the new movies that are being most talked about here for the summer, with John Serba from MLive, and Emmanuel Berry chats him up. It's National HIV Testing Day. We'll be talking with Todd Haywood and Dwayne Riley of LON. And it's also the century mark since World War I. We will visit with MSU historian Roger Rosentrater to learn a little bit more about the so-called war to end all wars. At the top of our program today, for over a week, the Detroit Free Press has been exploring the impact of Michigan's two decades of charter schooling. Much of the reporting has raised serious doubts about the oversight, transparency, and effectiveness of the state's nearly 400 charters. It cited instances of wasteful spending, poor academic performance, a lack of regulation, and resistance to reform. The paper also acknowledges some are well-run and effective. Democratic State Representative Ellen Kogan Lipton serves on the House Education Committee and represents parts of Oakland County. She joins us now to respond to the issues raised in the series and to comment about Michigan's Education Achievement Authority. Representative Kogan Lipton, welcome back.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
The Detroit Free Press has created quite a stir with its multi-part series on Michigan charter schools. It raises a host of serious issues. Lack of transparency involving public money, in particular, the charter schools in Michigan get nearly $1 billion of public money to operate. The influence of the for-profit companies and the boards that run charters. In general, what do you make of these stories?
Well, I think it's high time that we as a state start looking at how we manage charters. It's something that my task force last year looked at when we traveled around the state making recommendations, you know, systemic recommendations about school reform. And the third plank in our task force, of course, was charter accountability. So I'm very happy that the state can begin to start having a serious conversation about charters in Michigan, which are very different than charters in other parts of the country. Well, for one, 80% of our charters are for profit. That is far larger proportion by a factor of almost three than the next state behind us, which I believe is either Arizona or Florida, perhaps, which are in the 30% range. Secondly, we are unique in that the state, either through a Department of Education or legislative oversight, has absolutely no authority to close a poor-performing charter. In Michigan, the authorizer holds all the power, if you will. And we are unique in amongst the states in that the authorizers are not held accountable by anyone.
Well, let's go a little deeper there. Dan Quisenberry of the Michigan Association of Public School Academies, MAPSA, calls Michigan charter schools, quote, highly regulated, and maintains that there is a triple layer of oversight, the authorizer, the Department of Education, and he also cites the parents who choose to send their kids to charter schools. Is the problem with execution, or can this framework that Mr. Quisenberry refers to, can that be made to be effective?
Well, first of all, you know, as I said before, saying something doesn't make it so. You know, I can say the sky is green as many times as I want, and it doesn't make it green. So the fact that, people that are doing well and profiting quite nicely from the current system in Michigan say that it's highly regulated doesn't make it so. And I think that the proof is in the what we're seeing now after 20 years of, you know, unregulation. Is that what we know is that there are some charters that are doing doing well, and there are many that are doing no better than the than schools in their surrounding communities.
But again, Representative Kogan-Lipton, can this framework that Mr. Quisenberry refers to, can that be made to work, or does this oversight, does there need to be a different kind of framework as far as oversight goes?
Well, when you say framework, I assume you mean a different a different sort of infrastructure like we see in other states.
Well, he says again, the authorizer, the Department of Education, and parents effectively provide the oversight to charter schools. Can that framework be made to work, or do we need a different framework?
The answer is possibly if the department is given oversight, because as Mr. Quisenberry knows, the department has no oversight currently. So if the legislature gives the department oversight, as that occurs in other states, then it could work. And two, if authorizers were made to actually conduct audits and execute oversight function in terms of pulling charters from schools that are committing fraud or doing bad things, then yes, the framework could work. And thirdly, if parents were actually given appropriate information through very, very rigorous transparency requirements, which they're not. So yes, if we do what we need to do, then it could work. The problem is that we're not doing that, and it's not working.
And in your view, the MDE has virtually no authority here?
Well, I mean, I've read the charter statute. I mean, they don't have authority. The MDE has no authority to go in and examine these private contracts. Oftentimes, I mean, I've had to FOIA documents as a sitting legislator, so they're very hard to get. And number two, the MD doesn't have any authority when and if instances of bad things happening are discovered. Only the authorizer can pull the charter, but there's no one that compels the authorizer to do that. So sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. More often than not, they don't.
We're talking with Democratic State Rep. Ellen Kogan-Lipton, who serves parts of Oakland County. She also serves on the House Education Committee. We're talking about charter schools. We hope to get to the EAA here in just a minute. Your party's candidate for governor, Mark Schauer, spoke out on this issue yesterday, and I'd like to follow up on this issue of transparency and oversight. Part of what he said is he wants to subject private companies that run charter schools to the Freedom of Information Act. How would that play out in your view? How do you feel about that?
Well, it certainly would go a long way in terms of answering the question of which is what we oftentimes get when the public tries to get a hold of these private management contracts, which is they're private, you can't look at them, and it's interesting because there have even been instances of board members that have tried to get these are the board members of a particular charter school that have tried to get copies of these contracts various management contracts, and they've been told they can't get them. And when they raise a fuss about it, there have been instances where they've been let go. You know, thank you for your service, but we'll find somebody else that doesn't ask as many questions. So certainly, it would go a long way in terms of at least giving people some tools to get access to the information. But the Freedom of Information Act is, you know, can be somewhat cumbersome. And as I've learned when I tried to FOIA information from the EAA, and so I think that we need to go a step further in terms of simply requiring disclosure of this information. If you are doing the right thing by your students, there should be absolutely nothing to hide. And it should be made available to anyone who wishes to examine it. And to hide behind the curtain or the cloak of secrecy by saying that it's private, when you are being when you're making money, when you know you're the revenue you're getting is from taxpayers, is really sort of ludicrous.
Mr. Schauer stopped short of calling for a limit on the number of charter schools in Michigan or banning for-profit operators. Was he right to stop short of that, or should we be going there?
Well, we've tried that, right? We had a cap on charters, and then this administration and the legislature took the cap off, and so now we have, you know, an unlimited number of charters and even virtual schools. I think that a better model that we see in other states is rather than a numerical cap, to have a set of very rigorous standards that if you meet these qualifications, meet these criteria, and are really adding to the educational mix and opportunities that are available to all children, including those with disabilities, then you can operate. And if you don't, then you don't operate in our state. I think that probably is a scheme that works far better than a numerical cap, and it's what we see in high performing educational states like Massachusetts and Connecticut.
The issues become intensely politicized. More than one person has commented that it's become a litmus test. You're for charters, you're conservative, you're against charters, you're liberals. Doesn't this environment make reform harder? And how do we go about this?
Well, first of all, you know, it shouldn't be. I think that if you create these bright lines, you're really not you're oversimplifying an issue that's too important to oversimplify. When you're talking about the educational opportunity and educational challenges in our state, so I think that to divide or to create a litmus test, I really don't think it's warranted. I think that when I was traveling around the state working on the Education Task Force report last summer, what I found is that there are far more opportunities for agreement than not, and certainly, you know, common sense recommendations like I called for in our report in terms of, you know, common sense transparency.
We had the superintendent of one highly performing Lansing charter school on our program earlier this week. I'd like to play a comment of his and get your response. This is Brian Shaughnessy of Lansing's Cole Academy.
That's what you need to do. Hit specific schools that need to be fixed, not address all charter schools do this and all charter schools do that. And just like all traditional schools can't be lumped into that same category, charter schools need the same courtesy.
We've got just a minute, Representative Kogan Lipton. It was apparent that he and other charter school administrators are feeling thrown under the bus here. Where does all this concern and need for reform leave the quality, responsible Michigan charter school administrators?
Well, I think that hopefully will allow them to come forward, tell their stories about doing the right thing, because certainly he sounds extremely sincere, and I'm sure that there are others. And but that does not negate the fact that there are many others that are not doing the right thing, and the massive unregulation is allowing the bad actors to proliferate and make an enormous amount of money at the expense of our taxpayers and most importantly our children.
We'll have you back and talk more about this real soon. We want to thank our guest, Democratic State Representative Ellen Kogan Lipton. She serves on the House Education Committee. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. A short while ago, Current State's Emmanuel Berry previewed the first half of the summer film season with MLive Entertainment reporter and film critic John Serba. Emmanuel, what's the rest of the summer have to offer anyway?
Well, I spoke with John the other day, and there's a lot left to see. Marvel has the offering of Guardians of the Galaxy, which looks like it might be a huge success despite straying from the typical superhero movie that we see from Marvel. We also have the documentary Life Itself coming out later this year, which looks at the life of Roger Ebert, and many more to look forward to, as well as some to dread. Big cop comedies coming out, and we also have strange, digitally manipulated Ninja Turtles brought to us by Michael Bay. But before we moved onto July and August films, I first asked John if there are any films he has seen so far this summer that he was surprised by.
Well, from the first list, I totally expected Neighbors to be a dud, and this is the Seth Rogen comedy, and it's really crass, but, you know, there's a part of me that really enjoyed it and laughed at it quite a bit, despite this kind of hackneyed premise about the people living next door to the frat house and having to deal with it. And the funny thing is Zac Efron ended up being like super straight throughout the movie, where everybody else knew they were in a comedy. And Zac Efron ended up actually, I thought he was really funny just because he played the role so seriously and kind of went against the grain. That was one that surprised me for sure.
So up first for the second crop of films, I thought we'd talk about your favorite director, Michael Bay. the film is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. It's going to coming out in the second half of the summer. And I'm just going to say it. The turtles look absolutely terrifying. I would be scared if I watched this movie.
Well, you know, there's a there was always a friendly look to these overgrown, you know, ninja reptile things, and they've kind of like made them uglier. I don't know. Are they trying to Dark Knight this franchise up? I'm not sure.
It's about turtles who eat pizza.
And they ride skateboards and say cowabunga and whatever. And just to be clear, Michael Bay is actually producing
this
movie.
Yeah, he's the producer on this film.
So, because he was busy making 2 hours and 45 minutes of a Transformers movie that I have to see tomorrow. But so that's the thing that everybody is complaining about, is how like grotesque these turtles are.
If we can look beyond that, I mean, if we look beyond the grotesqueness of the turtles, is there any substance there? Is this something that's going to be interesting?
Well, Megan Fox is in it, so automatically you know that the you should lower your expectations as far as as far as acting quality goes. In the latest trailer just debuted, and Whoopi Goldberg is in this movie.
Really?
So I have no idea what this is going to be, except something that hurts your eyes.
All right, so another film that you had on your least anticipated list is Tammy, starring Melissa McCarthy. And from the looks of it, she's like reprising her role from Bridesmaids and The Heat. She's kind of playing like a quirky, weird person who's also a slob. This is the third kind of time that she's played this character. I mean, is it getting too many? Are we going to get bored of seeing this type of trope with her?
I've loved Melissa McCarthy since she was on Gilmore Girls. Remember the TV show?
Yes.
She was really, really funny in that show. And so I know she's capable of playing a character besides the dopey slob. And so when you see the advanced marketing on Tammy, you go, oh, don't get typecast here, you know. The other thing is, well, on the upside, she did co-write the screenplay, so hopefully she writes a decent character for herself. You know, there's a chance that she and Susan Sarandon, they play a mother-daughter duo who don't get along and they're on a road trip, another road trip movie. But there's the chance that they have some good chemistry, and even though Susan Sarandon looks also like a dopey slob, but you know, I'm really on the fence about it, and I just really hope it's not just her, not just McCarthy doing the same thing over and over again. We've seen this pony a couple times, so let's hope there's more to it.
One of the films you have on your most anticipated list is Step Up, All In. This is the gazillionth film in the series, actually the gazillionth. And in preparing for this interview, I watched the preview, and all that I wrote in my notes was why. So, John, why?
I am not too proud to admit that the previous, what comes before a gazillion? I'm going to say four. The previous four Step Up movies, they're actually good from a technical standpoint, the way that the dance sequences are filmed. You know, this series has routinely been entertaining because they kind of offer real bright, colorful, flashy dance routines. You're obviously not going to these movies to watch the profound acting, and there's something, it's a guilty pleasure watching these really over-the-top, ridiculous dance sequences. They defy gravity. They defy general laws of physics like that. They defy credibility. But they're really, you know, if they're done well, you can't help but kind of admire them, you know. I mean, the drama, forget it. You know, it's all the same canned crap that we saw in stuff like Fame and Flashdance and all those movies where, you know, the characters, if they don't dance, they'll die. this is at the bottom of my most anticipated list, mind you. It's number 15 of 15. But it's not that, but you know, I came clean. I don't mind the Step Up movies. I'll watch them all once. I'm good with that.
It's good to be honest about it. All right, so the closest thing to kind of a Marvel-esque superhero film that we have for the remainder of the summer is Guardians of the Galaxy, a group of small-time criminals in an alternate kind of alien world. They're misfits and come together on a mission of sorts. When I watched the preview, it made me want to watch Firefly, not so much watch the movie. But how do you think this film is going to hold up to other Marvel movies that have come out in the past few years?
Well, one of the reasons this is at the top of my most anticipated list is because it's a Marvel movie, but it doesn't have all the trappings of all the other Marvel movies. I'm getting really tired of superheroes at this point. Mm-hmm. And this fits into the Avengers franchise, but it's going to be more of a comedy. You have Bradley Cooper as the voice of Rocket Raccoon, who's this, like, heroic gun-toting space raccoon.
Those things are said in the sentence.
You have Vin Diesel, who's the voice of Groot, who's Rocket Raccoon's like best pal, and he's a big tree type man alien thing, and all his only line is "I am Groot." That's all he ever says. Which is just like the perfect role for Vin Diesel because it's one thing, and it looks like it's gonna be a different style movie, a different tone at least for the Marvel movies, and it's also tracking to be really big. I mean the latest scuttlebutt that I've heard is that this movie could do $100 million the opening weekend, just because it's coming at a slightly slower time of the year, and all of a sudden people are getting more and more excited to see it. I'm among them.
The film Life Itself is one that I hadn't heard of before I read your list, and it's a documentary about Roger Ebert. Tell us a little bit more about this film.
Well, it was being filmed by director Steve James, and it wasn't complete when Roger Ebert passed away last year in April. And it's essentially just a documentary profile about Ebert. And the majority of people just see Ebert as this guy that is one of the most famous film critics in the country, you know, and they'd see him on the talk shows, on David Letterman and all those kind of things. But what they don't really realize is that he is an incredible writer beyond just film criticism, you know. And he wrote an autobiography called Life Itself, which is an amazing read. I literally could not put it down. And part of it is because, you know, that's my profession. He's one of my heroes, and therefore I can't wait to see this movie. But, you know, he had a lot of health problems. He had cancer. And several years back, he started blogging about his experiences, about his life, and this kind of blossomed into his autobiography. And he is a really fascinating individual. You know, he's been through a lot of things. He's an alcoholic, all this stuff. And I think he is a much more well-rounded person than a lot of people realize he might be. I mean, he's a real sophisticated, funny, flawed human being, and I'm really interested to see what the filmmaker has captured of his life beyond, you know, just him being kind of the face of film criticism.
The film Calvary also made your most anticipated list, and I think this preview has one of the best opening lines. It's an Irish priest speaking to someone in a confessional.
What do you want to say to me? I'm here to listen to whatever you have to say.
I'm going to kill you, Father.
Certainly a startling opening line.
And it really is. Tell us a little bit more about this film and what you know about how it might unfold.
Well, the priest is played by Brendan Gleeson, and the guy in the confessional is a serial killer. So you have this interesting kind of, you know, that confession booth is supposed to be a sacred place where the priest holds your secrets. And what does he do? What does he do in this situation? Obviously, he's being threatened. The guy in the booth has killed other people. Does he break that kind of vow? And I think it's really, well, Brendan Gleeson is the reason I really want to see this. Some of the critics that I follow on Twitter were saying this is the best thing Brendan Gleeson has ever done, and he's an incredible, really underrated actor, you know. And most people remember him as Mad Eye Moody from the Harry Potter films, and you know that's where he made his money. But I loved him in Bruges alongside Colin Farrell, and he is a really, really incredible actor. You give him the right role like this, and you go, wow, I cannot wait to see this kind of thing. You know, this looks like a real strong, under-the-radar type release that will probably, it might snowball into some Oscar talk later in the year.
Well, John, as always, it's a pleasure to speak with you, and may you enjoy every 90 minutes of Step Up All In, every single one of them.
I'll enjoy probably 45 minutes of those 90 minutes of Step Up All In, the one time I see it, because you know it's not gonna last any longer than that, I'm sure.
John Serba is the MLive entertainment reporter and film critic. You can find his full list of the most and least anticipated films on MLive.com.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Quick friendly reminder, the end of WKAR's fiscal year is just about here. It's a great time to consider a donation to public radio here in East Lansing and WKAR. If you enjoy what you hear on Current State, please consider it. WKAR.org is our website. Go visit the Give Now link, and we appreciate it. Today is National HIV Testing Day. Across Michigan this weekend, there will be events and opportunities for free HIV tests And that includes Ingham County, of course, which has one of the highest HIV prevalence rates in the state. The nationwide campaign also offers a chance to look at how prevention and treatment methods have evolved and what barriers to treatment still exist. Here to tell us more about what's happening in the fight against HIV and AIDS, Duane Riley. Duane's the prevention coordinator for the Lansing Area AIDS Network, or LAN. Hi, Duane.
Good morning.
And joining him is Todd Haywood. Todd's a local journalist and HIV activist who helped build a new website, PrepForItNow.com, that focuses on HIV education and prevention. Welcome back, Todd.
Morning. Good to see you.
Good to see you. With today being National Testing Day, where do we stand right now as a nation regarding HIV testing? Are more people getting tested? Are fewer people getting tested? What? That's more better for you, Duane. Take it. Take it.
Yeah, you know, I think we're at a place where testing numbers have increased. Unfortunately, we still have staggering statistics, like one in every six persons who are dying or who are HIV positive simply don't know that they're HIV positive. And so I think, you know, with agencies like LAN, the Lansing Area AIDS Network, and the services that we provide, those numbers right there should definitely decrease. But unfortunately, we still have, you know, in the United States, we still have about 50,000 individuals who are diagnosed each year with HIV. And so there's, you know, even though testing numbers have increased, it's still an epidemic, and there's still a problem that exists within our.
Why aren't more people getting tested?
I think one reason would be stigma. You know, when you're thinking about HIV, people oftentimes take themselves back to the 80s and 90s, where there weren't many options for HIV, and so, you know, people are a little apprehensive and scared about getting tested, and so I think that's one huge problem right there.
So is awareness for the generation that did not grow up during the initial AIDS scare in the 80s and 90s, that's an ongoing awareness-raising exercise?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of other issues that are involved here, too. First of all, we talk about HIV today like it was the 1980s and 1990s, and the epidemic then is what's happening today, and it's a very different epidemic today. A person diagnosed today with HIV is expected to live a full life. Literally a full life, an expected life expectancy. That's something we don't hear a lot about yet. And I think that's really important. So there's this fear that if you have HIV, you're going to be dead in 2 months. And I remember when I was diagnosed, that was one of my presumptions. And that was in 2007. Well, at that point, we'd had 12 years of antiretroviral treatment that showed that that wasn't true anymore. Mm. I think the other thing, you know, talking about stigma, I think it's really important to recognize as well that 34 states, including Michigan, criminalize HIV non-disclosure. And it's the only disease that's criminalized in Michigan. And the ultimate defense is not knowing your status. If you don't know that you're HIV positive, you cannot face criminal charges under Michigan's HIV disclosure law. And we now have some studies that show that people who are most at risk for HIV infection are least likely to be tested in states where there's criminalization because they don't want to have to deal with the criminal liability.
And what about those populations here in 2014, Duane? What populations are most at risk for HIV?
Well, you know, one of the highest risk groups that has consistently been a high risk group, and that would be men who have sex with men. There's between the ages of 13 and 24, the youth group, that's a very high risk group right there for HIV infections as well.
Has that changed, or is that still, I mean, has that been a pattern in previous years?
Yes, it has been a pattern in previous years. I think now in 2014, we're looking at subpopulations that are even more increasingly disproportionately affected by HIV. Within the MSM community, African-American MSM, men who have sex with men, they're disproportionately affected with HIV as well. And so, you know, those numbers within those high-risk groups, they're increasing. But as far as, you know, how we're being infected and things of that nature, and the numbers and moving forward, it varies drastically.
Our guests on Current State, Duane Riley of LAN, the Lansing Area AIDS Network, along with Todd Haywood, HIV and AIDS journalist and activist. Todd, you've worked on a new website, PrepForItNow.com, which highlights some changes in HIV prevention and treatment. There are newer prevention methods, including what's called a pre-exposure prophylaxis. What is that?
That's correct. PrEP is the use of one of the anti-HIV drugs called Truvada, taken on a daily basis. It is 99% effective in preventing transmission. Mm. 99%. That is more effective than condoms. That is more effective than monogamy. That is more effective than any other intervention that we have today. If you use that in conjunction with behavioral modification, such as condoms, such as monogamy, you can reduce your risk to near zero.
Is Truvada expensive?
It is expensive, and that is one of the barriers. It's about $1,200 a month, so it racks up pretty quickly.
Any help with insurance?
It is covered by every insurance company that we've heard of. Medicaid covers it. The issue that we are seeing right now is some of the Obamacare plans are putting it in tiers where it's more expensive for copays. But the company that makes the drug does have a drug assistance program that will assist in cutting off some of those high copays.
And oftentimes it makes the cost zero. Yeah. And so
who makes it?
It's called Gilead is the name of the company.
Okay. How long has Truvada been around?
Truvada was approved as a treatment in 2004.
Okay.
And it was
a while.
Yeah. And it's really effective. It happens to be one of the drugs in my regime to treat my virus. So I'm quite well aware of it. It has very few side effects. In the PrEP studies that were done, there was some indication for a small number of folks who had stomach upset and that sort of stuff, and some people who had some kidney function issues. But as soon as they stopped using the drug, there were no kidney issues anymore. So there's nothing long-term that's been identified for this drug as a long-term side effect.
Anything else more recently on the landscape that people are still learning about that is good for prevention that some number of people still don't know about?
In regards to PrEP?
Yeah.
I think that with the current studies that we have, you know, it's proving exactly what Todd said. It can be very effective. However, one issue with PrEP is that people simply aren't aware of it. Mm-hmm. And so if you aren't aware of a resource, you know, how can you actually take advantage of that resource right there? And so I think that's, you know, one important thing in regards to PrEP for now. It's getting the word about this particular prevention option out there and other prevention options that we have in 2014.
In general, when people come for your help, Duane, mm-hmm. how aware are they of the more recent treatments and prevention?
Oftentimes, individuals aren't aware at all.
Yeah.
At all. And so, it's unfortunate, you know, even the highest risk groups, you know, they simply aren't aware of these particular prevention options for HIV.
In Ingham County, what is going on in our county? We have one of the highest rates of HIV infection mm-hmm. in the state. What factors are contributing to that?
I think education is definitely one thing in regards to sexual health and risk reduction for HIV and other STDs. That's definitely one thing right there. Risk behaviors, not understanding different options that you have to reducing your risk right there. That's one of the most important things I can kind of stress as far as HIV prevention. You know, you have, like, each situation is different, and I think it's important to realize which options will work most effectively with reducing your risk for HIV. And that's something that we really need to hone in, I think, as far as prevention specifically within high-risk communities in Ingham County.
Todd, do you know where we're at with regard to a vaccine?
You know, I don't follow the vaccine stuff very well. The reality is that I think we're at least a decade off. There's just nothing out there. But I think it's really important to understand that between PrEP and the use of treatment as prevention, what we do know is that when a person who is infected is on treatment and virally suppressed, that there's not a single case of transmission of HIV from that person. Mm. Not one documented out of 34 million cases in the world. That's a huge deal. And I don't think we're talking about that enough right now either. A person is rendered non-infectious with proper treatment.
What else is at prepforitnow.com?
We've got all kinds of videos from local opinion makers talking about why they took the test and how important it is. We're encouraging people to join the revolution. We believe that there is an evolution of prevention options out there now. Everything from condoms to PrEP to treatment as prevention, to behavioral modification and choosing which position to be in for sexual behavior. But it's all key to getting tested. You have to get tested for HIV. And if you're a sexually active man who has sex with men, you should be tested every 3 months or at the beginning of each new relationship. We know, in fact, with a lot of young MSM, 68% of new infections are happening in the context of primary sexual relationships. And so serial monogamy and the marriage movement actually is feeding the epidemic, because we haven't developed constructs to have conversations about when do you throw the condoms out, when do you negotiate not to have condoms, and that sort of stuff. The other thing I wanted to sort of step back on a little bit is there was a study released in 2012, so about 2 years ago, that the cohort of 20-year-old men who have sex with men had a 10% prevalency rate of HIV right then. 70 in the black MSM in that 20-year-old cohort 20% were infected. Mm. In 30 years, half of all men who have sex with men in that corridor will be infected, and 70% of black MSM.
That is striking. We're just about out of time. Yeah. Dwayne, where can people get free testing this weekend?
The Lansing Area AIDS Network will be hosting its national HIV testing event this Saturday, June 28th, and that will be from 4 p.m. to midnight. We'll be testing at the Diversity Psychological Services Building, located at 1310 Turner Street. We'll also have different games and things of that nature, and prizes and giveaways and raffles throughout the night. And in Old Town, we'll be collaborating with Esquire Bar and Spiral Nightclub in order to host this event right here.
Dwayne Riley and Todd Haywood have been our guests. PrepForItNow.com. Thanks for joining us
Thank
on
you.
Current State. Current State for Friday, you're tuned to 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's been a full century since the event that triggered what the world once called the war to end all wars. On June 28, 1914, the heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, was gunned down on the streets of Sarajevo. World War I hastened the collapse of old powers and saw the rise of new ones. Current State's Kevin Lavery is here with more. Kevin?
Hello, Mark. This is a fascinating period in history. That famous assassination set in motion 4 years of conflict that saw the start of mechanized warfare, chemical weapons, and the rise of communism. I talked with MSU historian Roger Rosentrater about the First World War, and we started with a short biography of Franz Ferdinand.
Well, he is the successor to the 84-year-old emperor of the Austrian Empire, Austrian-Hungarian Empire. He is a nephew of the emperor, and the line of succession was not as particularly good. Matter of fact, the Archduke Francis Ferdinand wasn't really well-liked in the empire. He had married beneath his station as a result. So even though he is a successor, he wasn't really, understandably, apparently, all that well-loved or respected.
What really was the Austro-Hungarian Empire? And there was another big empire just off to the east, the Ottoman Empire. So the map was very different a century ago.
The map was completely different. If you looked at that, the countries of Romania, Hungary, Croatia, Austria, Czechoslovakia, etc., all part of this really diverse and very unstable and weak empire. The Serbians in particular were angry at the Austro-Hungarian Empire, partly because a few years before the outbreak of this war, the Austro-Hungarian Empire had absorbed Bosnia and Herzegovina. And as a result, we come to June 28th.
Good segue. June 28th, 1914, Franz Ferdinand is in Sarajevo, which today is now Bosnia-Herzegovina. Before that, it was Yugoslavia. And he's in a motorcade. First of all, there is an attempt on his life, but it fails.
Right. Actually, he knew going into Sarajevo that he might, you know, run into some problems, but he didn't. There was really no security. Nobody worried too much about that. Matter of fact, even the car was an open-top vehicle, as it turns out, and he is riding in this motorcade, and there are several Serbian nationalists. Matter of fact, one historian recently equated him to the terrorists of 9/11. Simply saying that these were teenagers who were committed to, there were Serbian teenagers committed to die for the Serbian independence cause. Well, it's a little bit unclear if the Serbian government was involved or not, but as it turns out, the Austro-Hungarian Empire chose to accuse them, even if they were or weren't. But nevertheless, on June 28th, the Archduke and his wife in this open car, as you say, arrived in Sarajevo. Again, the visit was well published. And then these assassins, which were in a group called the Black Hand, there were several of them. And one of them threw a bomb. And that particular bomb was headed towards the Archduke's car. The driver saw the bomb. He swerved. Francis Ferdinand was able to deflect it with his arm, apparently. Then it exploded behind the car, injuring several aides and onlookers. That 19-year-old bomb thrower took a cyanide pill and jumped into the river. His suicide effort failed, as it turns out. He was hauled out of the river and apparently nearly lynched, did survive that experience.
Oh, but he had cyanide in his mouth. Not a pleasant way to be pulled out of a river.
The Archduke then went on to his destination, but then later in the day, and this is where it all unfortunately unfolds for him, decided to check on those who had been injured in the earlier explosion. His driver took a wrong turn, and when he turned around, there was another Serbian assassin among this group of the Black Hand who was simply standing there.
Gavrilo Princip.
Thank you for pronouncing that. He stepped on the car's running boards. He fired just two shots. One struck the Archduke, the other struck the wife, and they both died almost instantaneously.
His assassination, Roger, is viewed as the most immediate cause of the First World War, but certainly there were many others. That was maybe the linchpin. Was war inevitable? It sounds like there was political unrest in the empire and that was the course the continent was taking anyway.
It's a great question because by the summer of 1914, is my understanding that Europe was really kind of on a powder keg, as it turns out. There had been a century of relative peace in Europe, but for a variety of reasons, according to historians who know more about this than I do, things like the, for example, in that century, the growth of the population in Europe from 50 million to almost 300 million. There is the Industrial Revolution, which results in a lot of manufacturing, obviously, but there's still a fair number of people living in misery. The result is that you see a growth of a lot of doctrines, things like communism, socialism, anarchism. Then you add to that, among the greatest, nationalism, and then militarism, all of which, again, prepares us for this result in the summer of 1914. I mean, Europe is really ready to explode. One of the things we've not mentioned is how warfare had changed, and yet the strategies really hadn't, particularly things like the machine gun. Now, the European observers had seen the machine gun in use in the Russo-Japanese War of 1905, and maybe this is in keeping with the way these things work. They said, well, it shot down a lot of Japanese, but it wouldn't shoot down Europeans if we go to war. So they again missed that notion that the machine gun was going to play an enormous role. Barbed wire, which was a Western American invention for cattle, as you well know, is considered among the most important devices that impacts the soldiers' survival on the Western Front, artillery developments and the like. And all of that then contributes. And one of the amazing statistics that when we talk about these armies is that at the outbreak of World War I, with the mobilization of the French and Germans, they each mobilized armies of 4 million men. Now, the United States at that time is a world power as well. Our army was a paltry 100,000 men. Part of the reason that when we entered the war in summer of 1917, the Germans were relatively confident it would be too impossible for the Americans to actually show up and make a difference. They were wrong.
I'm thinking about General Blackjack Pershing, the Supreme Commander of the Allied Powers, American general from Missouri, who arrives in France, and his famous quote is, "Lafayette, nous sommes arrivés."
Well, you did a very nice job of that. And actually, it was an aide that said that, not Pershing, as it turns out.
That's usually how it happens. Usually yes, it's the flunky off to the side, right. But the top guy gets the credit.
The top guy gets the credit. Pershing is a fascinating character in his own right. By seniority standpoint, should not have been elevated to command the American Expeditionary Force. But what he really is adamant about, and this sometimes gets lost in the shuffle about American arrival in World War I, is the English and the French simply wanted us to send troops. Matter of fact, they said, don't even send generals, just send captains and from below, and we'll put these guys in our army and then we'll win, all right? Pershing was insistent that what was then known as amalgamation would not take place, that the Americans would fight under the American flag. And as a result, by the time the Americans got around to really contributing on the battlefront, it was months and months later. But he was insistent there would be an American flag. Matter of fact, even the Europeans said, or the British and the French said, just leave your flags home. And it was like, no, it's not going to be that way. And Pershing is really the guy, more than anyone, who simply said, no, it's not going to be that way.
As with every war, some things remain for a long time afterwards, and some things don't. The League of Nations that Woodrow Wilson so adamantly fought for eventually became the United Nations, an institution we still have today. Communism came into Eastern Europe. Sarajevo became part of the state of Yugoslavia, which eventually disintegrated into ethnic civil war in the early 1990s.
Any thoughts or observations on the legacy, the ghosts of World War I in that region of the world, and why we are still seeing today, 100 years later, the remnants of that era of violence and political strife in the Balkans?
My sense is that there's stability, more stability there now than in recent years. I don't know if that's untrue or not. I mean, I certainly hope so, since my son is planning to visit Croatia in a few weeks. But, you know, again, the map has changed, and maybe what we should think is that the map will change again. It's hard to imagine. I mean, Yugoslavia seemed like a stable, growing country, and it's gone, right? I mean, how long was Yugoslavia there? Even Czechoslovakia, which is now divided, correct? It's kind of hard to imagine that there would be more changes.
It's often said that people who don't learn from the past are doomed to repeat it. Almost 50 years after the start of World War I, we get to the early 1960s, the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. President John Kennedy was reading up on World War I when things were heating up in Cuba.
Yeah, maybe one of the legacies of this whole period is brought to us by historian Barbara Tuchman, who published Guns of August in the early 60s. It ultimately would win the Pulitzer Prize. President Kennedy was reading Guns of August, which again brings us to the events of World War I, the beginning of World War I, as the Cuban Missile Crisis was evolving. And again, if you know anything about the Cuban Missile Crisis, the world was spared a nuclear holocaust between the United States and Russia. Again, President Kennedy's military advisors suggested bombing Cuba. He hesitated with that idea and obviously didn't carry it through, and then urged his staff as well as Army generals to read Guns of August. So maybe some people did learn from the past.
Let's hope so. Roger Rosentrater is a professor of history at Michigan State University. Roger, great talking to you again.
All right. Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Current State would like to take a moment to share some bittersweet news. Today is Emmanuel Berry's last day. Emmanuel's been a fixture here on Current State from the beginning. She's been the host of Current State Weekend. And frankly, Emmanuel has been integral to whatever success has been attributed to this show. We are going to miss her. She's moving on to St. Louis Public Radio, where she'll be reporting on race and culture. We wish her all the best in her new job, which we all know she'll rock just like this last one. Best of luck, Emmanuel Berry, and thank you for all of your hard work here on Current State and at WKAR. That's our show for today. Coming up Monday on the program, we'll recap June's biggest Michigan news stories with a panel composed of Tim Skubick of Off the Record and Kyle Malin and Emily Lawler of MERS News. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to Emmanuel Berry, it's the last time I get to say her name, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also, thank you, Aaron Young, for engineering, Drew Henderson, for your assistance, and to Marie Steinbach for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Enjoy the first weekend of summer.